Q from Little Rock, Arkansas. That was a celebration.
My name is Joe, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. But as a result of God's grace that came into my life, as a result of this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the wonderful people that love me in this fellowship, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink today, nor has it been necessary for me to take a drink since March 10th, 1962, and tonight I am extremely grateful for this great gift. As my big book says, I'm standing here tonight, I know, with a way of life that I didn't know existed. And tonight I know a little bit about heaven from a gift unwarranted, from a loving God, and a bunch of people that didn't even know me. It's good to be here tonight. That's Lou Bell and I have been looking forward to coming to this conference. It's been a sort of a kind of a vacation period for us. We just had our Arkansas State Conference last week. We went home and touched base for a couple of days and took off again, and it's been a wonderful thing, very enjoyable. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting us. I never really like to make a talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it's something very special to me. It's until I fill myself with God's grace, and truly tonight, I am standing here through a gift unwarranted. They say in an AA talk, and if I am able to make one tonight, it will be through a gift unwarranted. We tell a little bit about how it was and what happened and how it is now, and I think these three things are very, very important to our lives. I think it is necessary that we talk a little bit about how it was so we can identify with each other. Surely one of the most beautiful drunkologues in Bill's story in a beautiful big book. If it wasn't there, I don't know where I would be. I think that this is what our program is all about. It talks about laying down our lives, that giving, sharing our experience, strengthening hope. And I think that the greatest gift that sometimes a man can give is his experience, lay down his life for another, so that we could see the pitfalls and avoid these things in our lives. And surely we're blessed for this great gift. And I think it's also necessary that we discuss a little bit about how it is now. And I love to talk about the many miracles that have taken place in my life in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had plenty, and I'm looking forward to plenty more. And we say in Alcoholics Anonymous, miracles are just a common thing. It's just basically getting what you need when you need it. And I've been getting this all since I've been in the program. But I think one of the most important things we must discuss is how this program works. But regardless of where we are in our lives of sobriety, and I stand in awe at my life. It's unbelievable that I could live and I could be as happy and I could be as contented. But still yet I realize there's a lot more in the problem of Alcoholics Anonymous if I could better apply those steps to my life. And it kind of makes me shudder at times when I think that probably I'm going to go to the graveyard with the best of it left in me. Because I didn't apply and seek out that growth that God has within me. I don't know how it began. Me, I was just a mixed up drunk and better to relax. That's a guy I told one that really struck me the other day. It's typical for a drunk. I guess it's about where my life was. Said this drunk was having, he had had a little problem the night before, and he woke up the next morning on the beach. And he was dragging along, just trying to make it in, and just about that time, a tragedy was just almost taking place on the beach. A man was drowning in the surf, and the Coast Guard had just barely pulled him to the beach. And this drunk was staggering along, and they were working as hard as they could to get the water out of him. They were pumping and pumping and pumping and pumping. And this drunk staggered up just at the wrong time and said, "What are y'all doing?" And they said, "Get away, get away." They were interfering, and they kept on pumping and pumping and pumping. And finally, the drunk said, "Hell," said, "if he don't get his behind out of the water, you're going to pump the ocean dry." Yeah. We drunks always end up in that sort of situation. But I remember how it began for me as an alcoholic. I think this is what's so beautiful about the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can look back at my past because I know I'm a product of my past experience. And I could see myself as I grew up, and I think I'm very blessed to be a person who's had a problem to have this tool in my life. And I know as I grew up, I know I was always restless and irritable and discontent in my life. I know I surely must have had some good times as a child, but I remember all the pain in my life. I remember the disappointments. This is a product of what I was. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and I came from a very poor family. And that wasn't unique in those days because everybody was poor. But I never did like my existence in life. And I guess I always was restless and irritable and discontent. And somewhere, you know, after I had about 18 years old, I finally, for the first time in my life, I experienced alcohol. I know tonight that probably I experienced some genuine relief in my life. I never forgot it. And it became an intricate part of my way of life. I remember my first drink very vividly, and I remember my last drink. And I had a lot of things to go on in between these two drinks. I remember, you know, the sense of ease and comfort that came from taking a few drinks. And I had a lot of problems as a result of that. I made a lot of bad decisions. Immediately, I can look back and see what happened in my life. Immediately after that, I decided I was going to this. I had just started in college, and I didn't really like what was going on in my life. I got tired of being broke and tired of all these other things, so I decided to leave school and get married. And that was one of the series of bad decisions I was about to make. I got married, and I moved to Indiana. And with a young marriage and a young drinking problem, it lasted about 5 years. And we were divorced. And I came back to Kentucky. And I know that, you know, to kind of look at my life and kind of see what was going on. And I really decided, you know, I think we all take these upper inventories somewhere in our lives. We always stop and think we don't do a searching and fearless. But I stopped long enough to look at things, and I decided, well, you just got married too early. You didn't have no fun. After all, things are going to be better. And I began to travel in out of Louisville, Kentucky, trying to find that place that I know tonight that never existed where I could drink and manage my life. And I spent quite a few years, and I spent a lot of hurt and a lot of pain. I know what it is to be broke, and I know what it is to pick up a cigarette butt out of the gutter. I know what it is because alcoholism carried me there. I had a father that lived in Kentucky at this time, and thank God, God let my father live to the ripe old age of 86 to let me find a good life. But in those days, you know, we had a strange thing going, and things were quite different. My father was up in age, and I would leave town and go off and get sick. Whenever I got broke, I got interested in my family. I never got interested until I got broke. Whenever I got broke, I said, there is your father. He's an old man. After all, you're not doing him right. You ought to go home and see how he's doing. And I would always go home and visit my relatives when I got broke. And my father, he wasn't like the prodigal son. He never did have his hand stretched out. He grabbed his pocketbook when he saw me coming. And the only way I could get any money out of him was, it was a shame. We're talking about we drunks are smart. I don't know how smart we are. My father was a hell of a lot smarter than I was. But at that time, you know, he was a little old fourth grade man, had a fourth grade education, and after all, I was a college man. I'm sort of like Will Rogers. It seems, you know, like the older I get, the smarter my father seems to be. But he would never lend me no money until I got ready to leave town. I found out he would always lend me money to leave. He would never lend me any money. And, you know, I would make these excursions in and out of town and get myself in trouble and come back and lose a job and embarrass him and take off again. And I had been away just for a short period of time, and it seemed like things had fallen apart in my life very shortly. And I had a spark of decency. I couldn't just subject myself back onto him, so I thought about a sister that I had in Little Rock, Arkansas. She had left, I hadn't seen her for about 7-8 years. She had went off there to go to school and get an education, and while she was there, she got married. And I hadn't seen her for about 6 or 7 years. And I thought about her. I said, now there's one you're not doing right. You're not treating your sister right. You ought to go to see her. So I think this was a great change in my life. This was the beginning. And I think, you know, this was the beginning of God, unbeknownst to myself, working in my life. Because I just thought I was going to Arkansas, you know, to to visit my sister, another escape. But I have realizations now that God was working in my life at this time. God took an interest in me because he loved me, not because he liked me. And I was to go to that part of the country where I had never been before to find some people who I never knew to show me a way of life which I didn't know existed. And this is the way I came to Little Rock, Arkansas that morning on the bus. I was broke and I was sick. And I was traveling everything I had in the world. I had a little suitcase. It wasn't too long. And typical drunk traveling, I work with alcoholics every day, and they still travel the same way. I don't know what class you call it, but it's a long way from first. But I had a little raggedy suitcase, and something about those drunk suitcases, the latch never works on both ends. You got to tie a necktie around it. You know, you probably still see those out. This is the way I came, and I think it's great. And I think people are always talking about have your goals. This is great. It's great to have goals. You know, everybody talks about the one-sided way of living. It's great to have goals in life. It's great to have goals. But it's also good to know where you came from. It's also good to know where you are. And I know where I came from. And I thank God I'll never forget it. And as I got there, I got a job as usual, and I always could get a job. I never seen a drunk couldn't get a job. If you drank like I did, you had to have quite a few professions. You know, I worked with alcoholics, and a guy came to me some years ago. He knew I was. He had some scheme, you know, to get a grant to help alcoholics. And he was telling me, you know, he wanted to set up a training program for alcoholics. I told him, hell, all of them I know need untraining. I ain't never seen none need training. But I live with my sister. You have to really understand that my sister is a very religious person. And she's a beautiful boy. Just still this one of them normal individuals, you know, this solid. Now, them kind of bug you, you know. Just been that way all her life, you know. You know, I couldn't stand that. Really, I couldn't stand that. But she had a beautiful little family, and they were struggling there. She just had finished college, and after about 6 years and 2 years having these kids, and they were struggling, and they really didn't need me. And this is where I ended up with those kind of people. We drunks always end up with the wrong people. Now, these kind of people that get up on Sunday morning and do all this church bit, you know, all that shoe shine and all that stuff, man, that's horrible when you done had a bad night. And you're trying to lay in a little bit. And you remember, it's embarrassing, too, when you're not contributing too much to the household. And they started asking me about church several weeks. And finally, they sounded like they was threatening me. So one Sunday morning, I went to church with them. And this is where God placed Bluebell into my life. And I think Bluebell's a great part of my life. Bluebell's a part of my sickness. She's a part of my sobriety. And this is why, you know, Al-Anon and AA together is in our home. And it's part of our lives. And I thank God for Al-Anon. But I remember, she tells another way how we met there at the church. And I remember Lou Bell was a good friend of my sister's. Now, my sister had always been involved in music, and she played the organ in our church. And Lou Bell was in the choir. Now, yeah, I know how Lou Bell was kind of overwhelmed by seeing this nice-looking young man at that time coming into the church with the organist. You know, that's after all. And my husband, her husband was the lay speaker of our church. Today, he's the pastor of one of the larger United Methodist churches there. But I had a pretty good front, a pretty good camouflage. And so Bluebell and I met there in the church. You know how we alcoholics operate, by selling fast conversations and them slow-thinking Al-Anons. And I give them my best shot, you know, and I didn't give them too much time to think. And we were married very shortly, in about 3 months. And really, this is when the thing really began to go on in our lives. And I remember we were married right at Christmas Eve, and it was, you know, it's okay to drink during the Christmas holiday, so I tied it on pretty good. And like the guy said, I always was a go-getter. I took her to work and went and got her. But that Monday morning, she went to work, and I was sitting there still drinking. You know, I sat there and drank and celebrated on. Everybody else is going on. I'm just celebrating. I celebrated another day. Finally, I celebrated the whole week. And I could tell along about Tuesday, you know, one thing about them, Al-Anons, they learn slow, but when they start learning, boy, they come on pretty fast. By Tuesday, she started figuring out what she had. Now, really? And this is why I say, I don't know, you know, the great wounds that I caused. And I know how she must have felt after 1 week of drinking. Because I made my first trip to the old nut house after 1 week of marriage and 1 week of drinking. 1 week in Aram nut house. I know how she felt when she went to church that Sunday and somebody said, oh, how is marriage life? She said, that fool's in the nut house already. She did me in 1 week. You know, I still have talked about the insanity of alcoholism, and so many times, you know, I think many of us think it talks about the insane things we do when we drink, and well, I think very vividly it's talking about the second step is after the first step. And the first step is after we stop drinking. So it's talking about the state of the mind preceding the first drink, the state of our mind sober. And I know today that I was insane, sober, because I had to be insane to pick up the first drink. And I remember in this old hospital, I was there, and I remember I was the smartest guy in the state hospital, smartest guy in Nut House at the time. And, you know, I work with alcoholics, and I'm trying to do things in my state and to make things better for the alcoholic. This is my world, and it's my work. But I'm really glad that maybe we didn't have some of the things like we have today for the alcoholic. Maybe in my time, it didn't work for me. Because they would have killed me to death with all these detox centers they got now. Because, man, we didn't have that when I was drinking. They just throw you in there with them. I was in there with 80 nuts. And you ought to try to sober up cold turkey and watch 80 nuts at the same time. Okay, I got out of there and I drank. And it went on and on. And it was another year before. And I was back and forth on these excursions. I was traveling drunk, and it wasn't much marriage in Louisville, and we had all kind of problems. And I was on one of these excursions in Kansas City where I went off and I'd stay for 3 or 4 months and drink and work and finally make it back. And I was in a bar one morning drinking, and God uses strange people. And I think this is why, you know, today I have to be so mindful of the people that God speaks to me in my life. Most time it's not the high and the almighty. Sometimes it's the small and the insignificant people that God used to speak to me. And there was a little wine I went to a bar in Kansas City, and I had been going to this particular bar. And that morning I went to the bar, and morning drinking was a thing in my life. And that morning, sitting at the bar, I lowered myself to go down at the other end of the bar. And we had a class system in that place. I lowered myself to go down there with the winos. They were way down at the end of the bar. And I was not a wino, by the way, unless my money said wine occasionally. So, you know, I went down there, and these guys were trying to get their money together to get a pint of wine. I think it was 55 or 60 cents. And after all, I had $4 that morning. And I always did like to help my fellow man. And these guys were scuffing, so I said, that's okay, I'll buy. And it was three of us there, and the customs do change in bar to bar. But in this particular bar, they didn't let the winos have the bottles. I don't know what they thought they would do with them, but they would pour them up in glasses. They would take a pint of wine and pour it up in glasses. And the way you would order, say, give me a pint on three or a pint on four. You know, that's the way we ordered. So that morning, we set a pint on three or four. And this girl set the glasses up, and she could pour those glasses. And when she started one in, when she finished, they would all be level. And she would just flip the bottle over into a huge paper barrel. Everybody on the street used to talk about how good Lucille was at pouring this wine, because she could pour it perfectly. Of course, she did it all day. And after she finished pouring it, all the winos got down and looked at it. You know, they got there. Because nothing is perfect for these kind of people. And sometimes they would vote or hold a meeting on which one, you know, they would examine them thoroughly. And finally, they would determine that one glass did have a hair more than the other. And classy people as they were, they would give that to the guy who bought them. So there I was, helping these winos. And God had a message from me, from a little guy named Van. You know, Van looked at me, and he began to talk, and the tears was running down his eyes, and he was shaking that morning. He was standing there, and he said, Joe, he said, you know, you're a pretty nice guy. Well, I'd been knowing that. And he said, Joe, you know, you're a lot different from me, and you're a lot different than the other Gladys guys down here on the street. I knew that, too. But then he said, Joe, you're drinking too much. You're drinking too much. Well, I'd had a lot of well-meaning people to tell me that. I had a psychiatrist at the hospital, and my medical doctor, and my minister, all my family, people I worked for. They didn't have what Van had. See, Van had a problem. It was obvious that Van had a problem. And it struck home, and I don't know where I'd be tonight if it wasn't for Van. Because he sold the seed, and I struggled out of that place, and I went to work, and I wrestled at that day, and in about 4 or 5 days, I just had to get out of that place and come back to, I came back to Arkansas to quit drinking. I came back to straighten up my life. And this would be my last attempt before I found the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had never seen it. It's a very strange thing, and I wonder how many people are yet in the world that were still like me. I know Alcoholics Anonymous was alive and well. But you know, in my life in 1962, I had never seen another alcoholic do nothing but what I was doing, drink and die. I had heard vividly, I'd seen some movies, but I had never met another alcoholic that was sober, and I had never met nobody that had met one. No, we were really anonymous, because I had never met another alcoholic. So I had no hope. Every alcoholic I seen drank and died, so I had no hope. So I decided, you know, I was going to quit drinking, and I didn't drink for 9 months. And finally, you know, after 9 months, you know, I know what happened in my life today. I know that, you know, that morning came, and I know what the big book says. And I think that this is what I'm so blessed today for our forefathers, for the people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous who laid down their experiences. And I was glad when I could come to open this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they talked about the day will come when we don't have the fence to get the first drink. And I could associate this experience in my life with the experiences in the lives of these people who laid it down, the first 100. Where would I be tonight without these people? You know, and that morning I took a drink, and I didn't know what was going on, but it went through the well-known spree. And after about 6 weeks of drinking, on March 10th, 1962, I ended up in doors of that same old state hospital, that old nut house. And this morning I was sitting on the bar, and I didn't know anything about God, very little. I had some religious training, but as far as I didn't have an understanding of God. And you know, I think in this program, that's what it's all about. This program ain't about finding God. So many, many times we harp, you gotta find God. No, ain't you. This program ain't about finding God. This program about giving up on me. And that's what I did on that bar. I just gave up on me. And God went to work in my life. And the very next moment I had the idea of going back to that old state hospital, and this is where I went. And as I got there that morning, I spent my... And I know it was the beginning of a miracle, because I had $2.50. And any time a drunk get off a bar with $2... A drunk, like a real alcoholic like me, get off a bar with $2.50 and spend $2 of it for a campfire at a nut house, that's a miracle. And as I walked back in there, I was hoping they would let me back in. In 2 years, I had swore I would never go back, but they let me in. And I don't know if any of y'all ever been to one of those type of institutions. It's a lot different. You know, it's a lot different atmosphere. Now, remember, you know, there were mostly mental patients in this ward, and they would see us alcoholics come and go for 30 days. And we were the status symbol of the ward. It's the only place where alcoholics in the world was the status symbol to be an alcoholic in this place. See, those people never had visitors. So their family put them in there and simply forgot about them. There was one guy there who was 36 and had been there since he was 6 years old. They would never have, they would become non-people. And I have seen, you know, really the people that yearn for love. I actually saw the people had desperation for somebody to be concerned about. So they would see us, the aides would give us a paper, they would even talk to us about the ball game, and nobody would associate with them. So when you went in there and asked one of those nuts what he was in there for, he said, "I'm an alcoholic." So he wanted to be in the big shot class. And of course, quite naturally, we alcoholics, when you asked us, we said we have nervous breakdowns, which was crazy. So you couldn't tell who was who by just looking, you know. So I told him I was in there for drinking. I didn't use that dirty word, you know. And I think they watched me finally on the third day, a little guy named Ora. And I thank God tonight for the life of Ora Guy. Ora's not with us. I don't break his anonymity. But where would I be tonight without little Ora and little Van and Lou Bell and all the people that brought me to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, these people that came before? And Ora You know, I didn't need a learned person in the skills of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and surely Ora was not. And I call Ora my 12-stepper. I give him that honor. Because Ora came to me, you know, with a week of sobriety and the big book and a carton of Camel cigarettes. And he showed love. He showed an interest in my life. And he sat down beside me. And he began to tell me is what he knew about the big book, which was, you know, not about this AA thing. And he was saying, you know, it sounds pretty good. And, you know, I didn't have any money. Like, I arrived there with 50 cents. I bought one pack of cigarettes. I think it was about 30 cents. And I blew the rest off some candy bars, and I was broke. And they gave me some of that roll your own tobacco and paper, but I never did learn how. I would try so hard to roll that cigarette, and God, man, you know, it would ball up, and I would light it, would fall down in my lap, and I would try so hard. Now, I didn't have any problem with talking about your life is unmanaged, because the only way I could smoke in that place was take my tobacco and paper and give it to one of them nuts and let them roll it, lick it, and give it back to me. And here this guy standing in there with a whole carton of ready-rolled Camel cigarettes. Now, that's a premium. I love the work of Paul. And I think it's so beautiful. You know, he talks about God's grace is sufficient. God's grace is sufficient. What Oral had was just enough. You know, and this sweet little guy sat down beside me, and he began to talk about the big book. And that Wednesday night, March 1962, Orr had given me cigarettes. Orr had shown some concern for my situation, which is love, simple love. And because Orr loved me, you know, he invited me, and I got, because he was nice to me and because he loved me, I got up out of the back wards of that old state hospital over 20 years ago. And I went out into a dining room to get a cup of coffee and a cigarette, because he told me these three guys from Alcoholics Anonymous brought cigarettes out and laid them on the table. They bought three packs of cigarettes and an old pot of coffee out there. And I went out there to get a cup of coffee and a cigarette. And God gave me a brand new life. God gave me a way of living that I didn't know existed. And delight, tonight I know a little bit about heaven. And this gift is unwarranted, because I surely didn't deserve it. And I met these three guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember, you know, I didn't knock down the doors of AA when I got out of that old hospital, but Oral told me to come back. You know, he came back to Little Rock, and I went out there to a meeting that night, and things were so much different. And I guess, I don't know what it was, but maybe not being in the hospital, but it was 6 weeks later, and I hadn't been to a meeting since I got out. And his guy drove 90 miles again back to Little Rock. And I went out there just to meet him. And it was something strange that happened there that night. And I think that is what is happening here this weekend. That is what has happened to AA groups all over the world, to brand new drugs. You know, our big book talks about it. It says, you know, that we are average Americans right here in this room tonight. We come from different backgrounds. You know, different social, different religion, different economic. Different races. There's a varied group of people here this weekend. Said we are normally people that should not mix. And truly, none of us should have never known the other. We have nothing in common. Said, but amongst us, you know, there is something that is indescribably wonderful. There's something very close amongst us as strange kinds of people. And it says we are like the passengers on the great liner. This beautiful illustration that talks about, I can see the people on this great liner, and I can see the man in the steerage section, this poor immigrant that was in the steerage section, you know, just barely paying his way over, and this rich guy that was at the captain's table, and all his finery. They had nothing in common. Their paths should have never crossed until they hit that iceberg and they both went in the water. Then they had something in common. They had a common problem that bound them together. And this is what binds us together. And that's what I found there at that meeting that night. I found the love. I found the common problem. I had the fellowship of these people and the support. But then my book said, beware. And I think sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, we depend so much on that common problem. He says, the other thing that we have, that we can join in Brothers Hartman's action, is that we have a common solution. And I found that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember, you know, I was, at the time, you know, this was 1962, and it's quite obvious, although my name is McQuaney, I don't get too many invitations to the St. Patrick's Day parade. In 1962 ain't the best time to sober up, because they were having demonstrations and all these other things about six blocks from where the club was. You know, it was all along the streets there. You know how Arkansas, Little Rock was at this time, right, the 57 situation. And all this was going on, and I showed up, and I always do everything at the wrong time. And, you know, I had a lot of problems during this time, but I think everything that we have to happen, and if you're a new person, the things that you have to happen are all necessary. And I realize today that these things are necessary for my sobriety and for my life, because God's timing is never off. And I remember, you know, that I would go to club some morning to the meetings, and one morning I went, and the manager called me in, and he said, "Joe," he said, "I want to talk to you." And he said, he would always call me son. God bless the old man. He's gone too. But something, he would always call me son and pat me on the shoulder. And that meant a whole lot to me. And that morning he called me in, and he said, "Son," he said, you're doing fine. He said, "But when you come to the meeting from now on in the morning," he said, "you can't drink coffee." He said, "As soon as the meeting's over, you have to leave." And you know, I came back. I came back because I had an admission to the problem of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to me, an admission means to, on a ticket it says, to let one in. And I had bought that ticket with my sufferings. My sufferings had given me a desire to stop drinking, so I came back. And I kept on coming back. Now, finally, you know, the whole thing turned around, and these peoples began to love me, and they began to share. You know, I had the fellowship, and I think this is what this program talks about. It also says, you know, this vital spiritual experience. And I think I picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and meet the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the most precise, specific, clear-cut plan. Program. And they said a program is a sequence. A program, the word program, means a sequence of events that are to occur. And if these sequence of events occur, they are guaranteed. And I think this is what our forefather was talking about, is rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And to me, I think the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a textbook, and it does three things in a precise manner. Number one, it shows me the exact nature of my problem. That's the first thing the book does. And it's a basic way to solve problems. You can't solve a problem unless you understand it. The first step to recovery is to understand the problem. Then my book explains to me the solution to the problem. And third and finally, it shows me a plan of recovery. And simply, I think the big book, number one, shows me where I was. And then it told me where I believed I ought to be. And then it laid out a plan to go from one to two. And you know, I was the kind of drunk, I didn't know where I was. I had some idea. But in order to recover, I had to know the exact nature of my problem. So I began to pick up these 12 simple steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God for Dr. Silkworth. Because you remember Dr. Silkworth told Bill what his problem was. And he talked about, you know, that it says, it was wrapped into the statement, powerless over alcohol, this was my problem. And I picked up this book, and I found out in step one, that I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. But this is where I was. In the doctor's opinion, it talks about the two phases of my illness. It talks about the allergy of the body, and I didn't know that I was allergic to alcohol. You know, when you, and I don't think many drugs know that they have a normal reaction to alcohol. Because when you have normal, the doctor says later, when you have normal all your life, you think abnormal is normal. You know. And you know, it says that I craved alcohol when I drank it. I didn't know this. I really never had looked at it. I guess that's why I thought everybody else used willpower, but they don't. He said they just don't crave it. It never occurs in the average temperate drinker. When I take alcohol, I drink my alcohol in my life, I crave alcohol. And he said, that's abnormal. And you don't have to be no genius. If you crave alcohol when you drink it, then ain't the one way to treat that. Just don't drink it. And you will never crave alcohol. Now, the other half of my problem was more complicated. And it says, we think the main problem of the alcoholic sin is in his mind. It says, I become restless and irritable and discontent. And then I would remember the sense and ease and comfort would come with taking a few drinks. That strange quirk of the man. And once I would remember, I would reach over and take a few drinks of alcohol, and it would shoot over and trigger the craving in my body. Boy, that's a trap. That is a real trap. And it says, you know, if you can't drink because of the body and you can't quit because of the mind, then you are powerless over alcohol. And that's the exact nature of the problem. Of course, once I saw where I was, and I think that this is what the doctor do. When we go to the doctor, the doctor does that simply. It was talked about yesterday, and alcoholism is a strange illness. In most cases, the doctor does a diagnosis, and the doctor prescribes the medicine, and then the patient helps the doctor with the treatment plan. When alcoholism is a sort of strange illness, then the victim has to diagnose, prescribe, and carry out the treatment plan all by himself, and this is why he needs help and directions. Now, once I saw where I was, he talked about, we believe you need to be over here. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore sanity. And I think that this is a came to believe. You know, what we're talking about to believe. You know, believe is our knowledge, our information price, the knowledge up front. It may be not to be correct, but came to believe. I didn't say I had to know, it just said had to believe. And to me, I think believe is very simple. It's sort of like just being suspicious. That's all you got to be. You don't have to know, you just have to believe. And it was easy to me believing because I had some wonderful people to look at. And I could look at these people and believe. You know, I think this, he didn't say believe that a power greater than ourselves said could restore me to sanity. I didn't have to know. But I had a lot of problems with this second step. And finally, you know, I look back, I think this is as old as mankind himself. And this program has been used since many, many times. The basic principles of living are always the same. You know, there was a little prodigal son, and he had a problem, sort of like I was. You know, it was in Seattle, an insidious problem. He had a problem of self. See, it talks about the sheep, and it talks about the other things involved in the coin. But this little prodigal son, the sheep was lost because of the sheep. And in that job, it was the shepherd's job to go find the sheep. So the shepherd went out and found the sheep. It was the shepherd's responsibility in that case. The coin was lost, and the woman owned the coin. And in that situation, it was her job to find the coin. So she swept diligently until she found it. The coin couldn't do anything. But the prodigal son and I were the victims of self-will. We had something different than the sheep and the coin. We had the ability of self-will. So the prodigal son left on his own. Remember, he said, you know, I don't want to wait around here for no funerals to get my money. I'm going to leave. You know, give me mine now. And he exercised self-will. He got off and he got into trouble. And that's a bad, you know, they say he was in a pig pen. And that's a bad place for a little Jew boy to be, you know. David gets on to me about that. But, you know, they don't like those things, but... And he got there, I don't know really what his problem was, but it mentioned wine, women, and song. So I don't know. It didn't say, I don't know if he ever made the program, but he was, you know, he's close to what we were. I had a woman say something to me one day or something. I said, Joe, I don't know if he was alcoholic or not. I said, well, you know, a little young boy don't waste his money on apple pie, hot dogs, ice cream, and Chevrolet. You know, he must have been doing something. But he said the key to the thing, the story was he came to himself. Said he found himself. You know, and he found himself. And that's what I did with the first step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found myself. I saw where I was. And that's the first step to recovery. And he used the second step too, because as soon as he found out where he was, then he said, you know, I believe they're eating better at my father's house. He came to believe. So once I establish these two parts, then we come to the third and final and most important purpose of our big book, chapters 5, 6, and 7. We have 10 beautiful steps laid out in this plan of recovery. Now, if you see where you are and you see where you want to go, your first step would be to make a decision. And we say a decision means to cut facts in two. And it says we stand at the turning point between these two great alternatives. We've gathered two facts. We make a decision. And our book said this is not the easiest decision for an alcoholic. To live life has been living a life on a spiritual basis. Over and over it talks about these two alternatives. But if you're an alcoholic, you know, these are the, with honesty, these are the two facts. And I stood at the turning point. And of course, my book very beautifully tells me about, you know, this first step in recovery, step three. It talks about the self-will of the alcoholic. And of course, I hear a lot of people, you know, as we sometime around the fellowship, we begin to talk about the program. And sometimes we distort things, you know, we get close to what we say, but, you know, as repeating it by word of mouth, we distort the program. And I hear a lot of people in AA say, well, you got to find God. You get a third step says you got to find God. You got to find God. I don't see that in the third step. My book talks about removal of self. The purpose of that step is not to find God, but to remove self. God ain't lost. If he was, a drunk couldn't find him. But how do we rid oneself of self? God makes that possible. So in the third step, you know, I made this decision. And this removes self, the root of my problems. And I know, you know, that all my life this was a problem. Way before I drank, all my life, self was the root of my problems. Right today, self is the root of my problems. This is not new. This is not a new concept. Many years ago, they asked the Nazarene how to find his way of life. What is the first step in your recovery program? And he said, deny thyself. Once I got self out of the way, my book says that all good ideas are simple, but this one simple idea is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. The keystone. Because it removed the center of my problem. And then I had to go to work on the things that grow out of self. You know, I think, you know, we can notice a self-centered person, and Bill talked about it so beautifully in 12 and 12. I think it's a thing that I read over and over and over and over, and a great insight. And I just wonder how many people in the world, non-alcoholic, you know, if they had the opportunity to have the understanding of life that we find in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We learn how to live. We find out how it really is in this program. It talks about, you know, these natural instincts which are necessary and God-given and play a vital role in our lives. Because of self, they are overused and they are underused. And they are distorted. You know, our excess becomes our liability. And it talks about resentments and it talks about fear. All these things that I didn't even know I had, you know. So I had to go into this thing. And step four, I take a searching, fearless moral inventory. I had to find the things that grow out of self. And I'm a product of this thing right between my ears. I'm a product of my mind. And they say, so is a man thinking, that shall he be. And if I wanted to be somewhere, I had to change my thinking. I had to change my thinking. So I had to begin right from within. So I went to work on these things in step four, and I did this written inventory. And I laid these things down for the first time, and I think step four comes as a result of three, because with no way that a self-centered person could take a searching, fearless moral inventory. But once we are relieved of self, then we're given a gift to see ourselves. And then step five, you know, I was able to bring these things to the surface. A beautiful little step. It's not a step that is thumping, but it relate to God, ourselves, and another human being. And so much throughout this step, you know, this is the rhythm of life. This is the way our steps lay down, the same rhythm. Number one, two, and three, we come to God. And then four, five, six, and seven, we work on ourselves. And eight and nine, we clear up our relationship with other people. And step five is laid out on the same rhythm, God, ourselves, another human being. My mind plays the next role, and then my relationship with people. So in step six and seven, once I've seen these things and got them out to service, I made these adjustments. And in four, five, six, and seven, I worked on me, ourselves. And then, you know, it talks about, you know, the outer area of our lives, our relationship with people. And quite naturally, if we say we agree to go to any length, if we don't clear up our relationship with people, then we're going to have problems in our mind, guilt. And if this guilt builds, it will cause problems in our spiritual life, and we may drink again. So it's necessary that we go out. In these two beautiful steps, we clear up our relationship with other people. And then I had three steps that I practiced day in and day out. Step 10 talks about it, and I begin to work. And I think sometimes the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that so many of us use the program as a not, we become, somebody called us a not drinking program, somebody. And we've known as the world as a place to go not to drink, but it's really a place to live where you won't have to drink. And it's a living program, and I think that we miss the real quality in our lives. You know, after step 9, it talks about the promises, and sometimes we take these promises out of the book, and you know, it's very damaging when you take things out of the book. Leave them in the book, read it all. The promises are fit right after the 9th step. And it talks, you know, even though we're halfway through, we'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. And we come to this plane of life after the 9th step, and then it talks about, you know, at the 10th step, if we continue, we can go farther. You know, and there's no limitation on the quality of our lives in this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that we can live better than most people on the face of the earth and face adversity. We are blessed. We are truly blessed. I am truly blessed to be an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous, to have this way of life. And step 10 tells me to watch for self creeping back in. And this was 1, 2, and 3. And it says, watch for resentment and fear, which was 4, 5, 6, and 7. And when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. So that means each day of my life, I can look back into three major areas of my life, and I can eliminate and grow. And so much the people say, you got to get this, you got to get that. And I ain't even seen them in the book where you got to get nothing. Everything I tell in the book tells me to get rid of something. Books are all about eliminating. You know, take away my difficulties. Relieve the bondage of self. Remove the things from me of objection. You don't get nothing. You get rid of something. And as we eliminate, we can grow and grow and grow for the rest of our lives. Step 11 talks about, you know, the receiving of God's will. So much step 3 is the turning over, and step 11, the foundation of our program. Clear the things that block us off from God with these steps. And then step 11, receiving God's will. So much this is the foundation of living. And it talks about, you know, that how to work this step, and it says, you know, if we practice at this is not an easy thing. It takes time. But as we practice this step, you know, what used to be in the cage and the hunch became a working part of our mind. It talks about we develop a sixth sense of direction through talking and listening to God. It tells me exactly how to do this, you know, and we have to practice at times. You know, I might not have the inspiration that's necessary and know which decision to make, but, you know, I can turn it over to God and don't struggle. And the right answer will come. Now, I got a little computer up here. It's very limited, and it's got too much information in it. And every once in a while, you know, I run into a problem, and I'll go up there, and they say, well, we don't have no answer for that one up here. And usually I turn it, keep it, finally says, it ain't here. You know, I get frustrated and things that my book says cut it off. And once I cut it off and go on and do what I can do constructive in my life, after a while, I get some more information. When I crank that problem back up, something tells me, well, why don't you go over and see so-and-so? And I carry that out, and I can find answers. I think, you know, that once we become assured and practice this step, you know, I really can work. We can walk to face this earth, and we can face problems. I don't travel on self anymore. I don't have all the answers for all the problems, but I have a source. I have a source for answer to every problem in my life. All I have to do is deny self and plug into this power that is within. And it talks about these 11 steps. And then after that, we have our beautiful 12th step. And I think that the 12th step is probably one of the most important things to our fellowship. And surely Bill must have thought this away, because he devoted a whole chapter to the book on the 12th step. And it talks about this 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual awakening. It's really a promise, because it told me I would believe that this would take place. And now it says, having had. As a result of these steps, we carry this message. It told me, you know, if you've had this vital experience, spiritual experience, as a result of these 11 steps, you are supposed to carry this message to other alcoholics. And there's so much by God, it says, you know, if you have witnessed my love through the change in your life, then carry this to another human being. And I don't know, we don't know where I would be tonight if it wasn't for these three great guys from Alcoholics Anonymous who came to that old hospital door in March 1962. And I think this is what's vital to our fellowship. Because it tells you, you know, you cannot transmit what you do not have. So it says those who have had the spiritual experience, those are the messengers. Now, we don't want believers to carry no message. We say the one who knows. So it's been a great part of my life to have an opportunity to carry this message to other people. And I think it really gives me a real purpose for my whole life. And I think that this is what our book says. The purpose of this program is not to stay sober. It's not to get good. It's not to be a good citizen. Not to be a good AA member even. The main purpose is to fit ourselves, maximum service to God and the people around us. And I really feel at times, you know, that sometimes I get close to this in my life. To actually realize, you know, that I'm here and I'm able to do the things and I can realize why God created me. You know, it's really a marvelous thing to, and many people don't have that satisfaction. And I think about all the people going to be on this face of the earth and don't even know why they was put here for. To be able to fulfill the purpose of our Creator in the lives of other people and carry this message to those who still suffer and offer them freedom. And our book says, you know, this is the greatest thing in this fellowship is to help others and watch loneliness vanish in the individual and watch him get up and help others and say, I hope you don't want to miss it. And I thank God I haven't missed this in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're only messengers. We're not healers. Sometimes, you know, we get too far with that. We've got to heal folks. You know, we ain't no healers. We just got a healing message. The healing power lies within this big book. And it lies within God. We are simply messengers. Just a humble role. Now, I'll never make a talk about it because I think the greatest example of a messenger was Paul Revere. Paul wasn't really part of the hierarchy. You know, he wasn't the big shots in that outfit. He was a little peon. And he was, by the way, he was a man who worked with his hands. He was a silversmith, by the way. See, they didn't send none of those intellectuals out that night. They said, oh, Paul. And they said, Paul, tell them the British are coming. And Paul did exactly what they told him. He rode the horse. He never did get out of his horse to give no advice. You know, he did his job. And that's what my book tells me to do. Tell the people about the grace of God. Tell them what God did in your life. They said, if you don't want to hear it, go find another. Somebody else will be interested. You know, I often wonder what would happen if old Ben Franklin had been on that horse. We'd all been British citizens. He stopped on the first corner. Right in his mouth. Making a speech or something. In closing, how it is now, I've had many, many miracles in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I talk about these things, you know, I am a very small, insignificant person in God's world, but still all of us have a role to play. And I used to wonder sometimes, you know, why all this? Why? Why did God have worked in my life? Even after why he didn't, why did he? So I began to do what people told me to do. I began to give of what I had the best I could. And the only place I knew was other drunks. And, you know, very shortly after, I'll tell you about my old trouble at which was a rehab facility, and I couldn't stay there. And they just barely would let me come in. But after about 4 or 5 years, when I sobered up, they began to let me hang around. I would go there every morning to sponsor drunks. And I sponsored drunks and worked with them. And really found my niche in living. After about 5 years, you know, of working around that old rehab house, they finally asked me would I serve on the board of directors of the place where they would even let me stay. Now, that was kind of a switch. And I did what I could. And I served as best I could for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. After that time of sobriety, then, you know, other things began to happen across our state. And to work with people, and people that saw my interest in the alcoholic, and the governor saw fit to appoint me to several state commissions and boards to work with alcoholics. And I served, and still continues to serve, for the last 10, 12, or 13 years. And up to January, the first of this year, for 3 years prior to that, I had been a member of the 6-member authority that controls all the alcohol and drug programs in our state. You know, it's very wonderful. It's almost unbelievable a person that couldn't get in the door of one. Through God's grace and through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, through Alcoholics Anonymous, that has allowed me to be a part of other alcoholics' lives and to grow and to live and to function in the world in which God fulfilled God's design for my life. It's been a wonderful life, and Newbell and I have, like I say, A and Al in our lives. It's a great opportunity to have been here this weekend, and we thank you for the opportunity of saying thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's what it's all about, you know, is saying thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Saying thank you, God. And a lot of times people say attitude is a gratitude. I've heard that a lot. But God expects it to become an action. Gratitude becomes an action, not just an attitude. And in closing, one of my favorite stories, I think about the story of the Bible when these people came to Christ to be healed, these lepers. And I think I can see so more beautifully how he went along with the programs of that day. He didn't offend nobody, you know, even. And, you know, the lepers didn't let them come around people. They kind of treated them like alcoholics, you know. They made them stay off, kind of pigeonholed them, you know. And he went along with the programs because he wouldn't break down any of the laws of man. And as these lepers came to be healed, he told them, he said, well, wait a minute, you know, y'all go on toward the temple and it'll be all right. And as they left and went toward the temple, they were healed. And but one came back. And I think that's really about the same program we got today in Alcoholics Anonymous. 10 get it, 1 come back. People haven't changed. But you know, I often wonder about those 9 that didn't come back. I know that they escaped from the problem of leprosy, but probably they had some other problems in their lives that they didn't have answers for. And I see that they probably, as they got healed, one of them said, well, man, I got to go down and see about my girlfriend. And the other one said, man, I got to get a used Campbell. You know, man, I need to get some wheels. And I'm sure all of them had something very important to do. But this one guy came back. And he said, thank you. And Christ looked at him and he said, but where are the other? But you came back. And he said, thy faith shall make you whole. See, this man had answers for problems for the rest of his life. This man had knew he had something to live on. Because he come back. And he said, thank you. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.